Well, actually, I'll call the case. This is Judge Hooten, and the file number is A20-0113. It's the state of Minnesota versus Angelica Easterling. And counsel, I do want to apologize for our technical difficulties this morning, but we are going to proceed with all the three judges having audio, at least an audio connection, if not a video. At this time, I do want to instruct the attorneys that they each have 15 minutes for oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself and your client prior to beginning your oral argument. At this time, then, the appellant may proceed.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay, very good. There was an issue with audio. My name is Stephen Grigsby, and I'm the appellant's attorney, whose name is Angelica Easterling. I don't expect to take the full 15 minutes, but let me begin with that. This is a case in essence where the record shows that the police did enough to develop probable cause to make an arrest, but they did nothing further, including the drug recognition protocol that is critical to determining whether there exists proof beyond a reasonable doubt of a marijuana impairment. They didn't do that, but not only did they not do that, I think a central feature of this case is that normally field sobriety tests, at least with respect to alcohol impairment, are used to develop ultimately an expert or even lay opinion that the person is in fact impaired by a particular substance. In this case, I look very carefully at the record, and I noted that the only opinion is on page 31 of the transcript. It was elicited by the state and responded to by the testifying officer, that when he's asked, what conclusions did you draw from? And in this case, it was the testifying officer's observation of another officer's performance of the field sobriety tests, that he had enough to make an arrest. So there is actually nothing in the record here that even is in the form of expert opinion that takes the various threads of data gathered through the performance of the field sobriety tests and resolves that into an opinion that the person was in fact impaired by marijuana.
Can I just stop you for a moment? Is there any issue here that, I mean, as I understand, it was stipulated that there was marijuana in your client's system at the time of the stop. Am I correct?
Well, there's no question about that, and neither is there any question that there is an admission to recent ingestion of marijuana. This is perfectly clear from the record, and that's not in any way in dispute. But the issue is whether or not there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt of impairment. Specifically, impairment is not ingestion. Impairment is not the presence of marijuana in the system, unlike the statutes that essentially criminalize any detectable, measurable amount of particular substances in the body. Marijuana is unique in the statute in that they actually have to show a cause and effect relationship between the ingestion of marijuana and impairment in the physiology of the person that is being examined.
Counsel, this is Judge Cochran. Can you cite us to any case that requires...
Go ahead.
Can you cite us to any case that requires an opinion evidence in order to sustain a conviction for impairment? I don't see that in your brief, and it seems to me that you're asking us to establish a new legal principle in this case.
Well, I don't believe there are any cases that require an opinion, but there at least has to be something in the record that brings together the threads of data and explain why impairment is the condition that's in fact being observed. Because there was no test here of the sort that is achieved in other types of scientific performances, is that is in essence opinion by somebody with knowledge is about the only way you can prove the existence of impairment by the observation of various performances of tests. I've done a variety of these appeals in the context of of alcohol impairment. And in those cases, when I argued that the basis for the field sobriety tests was not scientific and therefore they should be excluded, this court has said, citing other precedent, that even a lay person can offer testimony to establish impairment. I think the matter is slightly different between alcohol impairment and marijuana impairment, because the collective experience of alcohol impairment is so vast and has been in existence legally for literally millennia, that this become that the effects and the signs of alcohol impairment are really almost self-evident. That's not the case with marijuana. The standard ways in which people see people, whether they're impaired by marijuana, doesn't have those obvious effects of alcohol. There would have.
Is there any counsel? The connection is a little challenging today. But is there any evidence in the record to support your argument regarding the distinction between the level of evidence needed for alcohol versus marijuana? I don't see that in the record, and it appears to me that you are just merely asserting that, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily anything that would appear in the record. They're distinct substances with distinct effects.
But there's no scientific evidence that you presented on behalf of your client to support this argument, correct?
No, the client relied entirely on the presumption of innocence, meaning that any inference that is not specifically proven to be the contrary by proof beyond a reasonable doubt must be deemed consistent with her innocence.
And what would you agree that we would apply the traditional sufficiency of the evidence standard to determine whether the evidence is sufficient in this case?
I don't think this is a contested. This entire appeal was based upon the premise that the evidence was insufficient. I don't know that this is an issue specifically to this case.
I didn't see any discussion of the sufficiency of the evidence standard in your brief, so I just want to make sure that you agree that that's the appropriate standard.
There's no question that's the appropriate standard. The brief, sort of as a sort of the a priori condition of the argument, is that the evidence was insufficient to support a conviction. The argument in the brief is developed in relation to that standard. I don't know that it was said expressly, but clearly that's the only issue that was raised on appeal, and that's the issue that we argue in the conclusion to the brief. But I think what is really critical here, though, is that there is simply no objective standard that was offered in this case to determine the existence of impairment by marijuana. There was no testimony to describe what specifically marijuana impairment would entail. Such a description would have to include very specific physiological deviations from a norm that are specific to marijuana. None of that was there. In essence, what this case was a officer who testified, observed a third party in training perform field sobriety tests that themselves don't have any specificity to marijuana. They declined the drug recognition protocol that is actually specific to the detection of impairment by marijuana. And finally, never even offered an opinion other than that there existed enough for probable cause to arrest. And that is essentially the evidence. It's not disputed that they had evidence for probable cause to arrest, but it's precisely that quantum of evidence that distinguishes probable cause for arrest for proof beyond a reasonable doubt of impairment is what is absent from the entire record here. I think that an opinion in this case may not have been sufficient ultimately, because the court would have to weigh the strength of that opinion in relation to the evidence from which that opinion is an inference. But in this case, there isn't even that. So even if an opinion is necessary, let me say I had that wrong, that even when an opinion is offered, it is evidence among other evidence. But in this case, not even that opinion was offered, and you're essentially putting the court in the position of essentially making inferences that are essentially expert in nature without the assistance of an expert, or without any even scientific test that by its very own internal logic is designed to render the conclusion that somebody is impaired by marijuana.
All right. So is your argument essentially that you cannot give an opinion regarding impairment without some kind of test? Is that what you're arguing?
That's not the sole argument we're relying on. What we're saying is that if there had been opinion, then it would have been fair game to address how that opinion was formed on the basis of the evidence that existed by the witness who testified. But what I'm suggesting is that in this case, there was no scientific test, and there was not even ultimately an opinion that the person was in fact impaired by marijuana. The only opinion offered in this record is that there was probable cause to make an arrest. That is our argument.
Well,
are you arguing
make that determination when you need to have an opinion that there was impairment?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I mean, by virtue of offering an opinion that there was probable cause to make an arrest, I mean, doesn't that necessarily involve an opinion regarding impairment?
It does, but it only is an opinion that there existed probable cause to make an arrest. And absent something more than that, that would be in the form of, officer, did you form an opinion that the person was actually impaired? That's different from whether or not there's a sufficient amount of evidence to proceed with an arrest. I mean, the two standards are vastly different, and the state didn't go beyond the evidence of probable cause, or essentially reiterated the evidence of probable cause as evidence of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
So, Mr. Bixby, this is Judge Flory. It seems to me we'll have to apply a circumstantial evidence standard of review to this issue. And it seems like the circumstances that were proved that would support the verdict are driving conduct, cutting off the bus, the officer smelled marijuana upon approaching the vehicle. They observed other indicia of intoxication. There was, your client admitted smoking marijuana within an hour of driving. It seems to me that those facts supported in the record would support the court's verdict here. And I'm wondering if there's some other reasonable inference from the record that could be drawn that would thwart that determination.
Sure. There's an unpublished case that I cited. And in that case, I think I use it for precisely the predicament that the court is mentioning, that even though a person has marijuana in their body and has ingested it and even has an accident, the accident can be explained in the same way many accidents explain that aren't the cause of marijuana impairment.
There was other observations of impairment that were made, and there's no claim that alcohol was involved here. So, you know, there's the smell in the car, and there's an admission of smoking within an hour. What other reasonable explanation for those observations would there be?
Well, the other explanations are precisely those that would not be excluded, that are mentioned in the case, I think it's Subhar, in which everything not excluded by the evidence, proven beyond a reasonable doubt, has to be deemed to be consistent with innocence. There are a variety of reasons a person could have appeared exactly as Ms. Easterling appeared without being the specific causation, that nexus of causation between her condition and marijuana.
Counsel, isn't this case distinguishable from Suber, though? Because in the Suber case, there was testimony from Mr. Suber himself that he hadn't eaten in 16 hours and hadn't slept for a long time and had Asperger's. Here, if I'm recalling correctly, your client did not testify, and there isn't similar evidence of some other possible cause of the turning in front of the bus and in other words, there isn't any rational alternative hypothesis that for her lack of proper driving in that circumstance, which I think indicates a lack of clear intellect and control.
Sure. And I think this is the critical point. I see I'm out of time, but I'll answer the question very briefly, if I may, is that all of the things that the defendant or appellant testified to in the case, the court mentioned, are not things that he would have been required under the presumption of innocence to actually offer. All of these would be hypothetical matters to which Ms. Easterling would be entitled as a matter of the presumption of innocence if they're not disproven by the evidence that the state offered.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree that that's the correct application of the circumstantial evidence standard, but maybe you can address that more in your rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, the respondent may now proceed.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
All right. Good afternoon to the court, Mr. Grigsby. My name is Clifford Berg. I'm an assistant St. Paul City Attorney. I'm the attorney for the respondent, State of Minnesota and City of St. Paul, in this case. Your Honor, as the state sees it, the case, the issue that's presented to the court in this case, and I would agree with the Mr. Grigsby in this much, is that the sufficiency of the evidence is what's before you here. And the standard that the reviewing court applies when considering whether the evidence was sufficient is whether the evidence, when viewed in the light most favorable to the conviction, would allow the fact finder to reach its verdict, in this case, a verdict of guilty. That standard assumes that the fact finder believed the evidence supporting the verdict and disbelieved contrary evidence, and the verdict stands if the fact finder could reasonably conclude guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. As it applies to a impaired driving, whether by alcohol or a controlled substance case, the sufficiency of the a person is deemed to be impaired when the driver lacks the clearness of intellect or control of herself that she otherwise would have. The standard doesn't require a set quantity of a controlled substance, and the impairment of their judgment and ability to safely operate and maintain control of their vehicle is what's required to be found. In this particular case,
Mr. Berg,
yes.
Mr. Berg, this is Judge Flory. Do you agree that we would apply a circumstantial evidence standard of review to that analysis?
I think that's applicable, Your Honor. I do, and I'm prepared to address that. I think that, as was alluded, if there are no other circumstances inconsistent with the verdict of guilty would be allowed to stand. In this particular case, there weren't any alternate explanations offered, whether the driving conduct was a product of fatigue or if there was some other disability that Ms. Easterling was operating under. Evidence, as I understand it, consisted of an admission of the driving conduct that was observed driving in front of the school bus, the admission of the use of marijuana, the smell of marijuana, and the observations of the officers, and ultimately proof of consumption through the collection of a blood sample. So while I would agree that a circumstantial standard would apply, there weren't any other explanations offered that would reasonably fit in light of the evidence. The argument that that the appellant is making seems to be asking the court to disregard some of this other evidence. The officer, in this case, Officer Avent, was not asked to provide any ultimate opinion, but his observations are only one portion of the totality of the evidence that the trial court considered. Given that at trial most of the elements of the offense were stipulated to, the only issue for the trial court's consideration was whether or not Ms. Easterling were impaired. And as I understand the appellant's argument, it seems to me that they're asking the court to adopt a standard that either a drug recognition examination would be required or that some sort of opinion would be necessary in order for the court to make its determination. In this particular case, this was a court trial, not a jury trial. So the trial court was in the position of the finder of fact and had the ability to listen to the evidence and weigh its importance and assign what importance to give each piece of evidence. I would point out that one of the cases that the appellant relies upon, the Clawitter case. The Clawitter case speaks more to whether or not a DRE or drug recognition examination is appropriate when a fact finder needs to make a decision. There was no DRE done here in this case. So while I would concede that perhaps the DRE may have been valuable evidence and perhaps could have given the court some other sort of guidance in making its decision, there isn't any requirement that I'm aware of in the law that would require such an examination.
This is Judge Cochran. Can you address appellant's argument regarding the differences between alcohol and marijuana and the need for and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing his argument, but I think he was arguing basically that the evidence was insufficient because the officer's testimony that the impairment testing was enough for an arrest isn't sufficient to show impairment even with the other facts in this case.
All right, the distinction between alcohol as opposed to marijuana, Your Honor?
Yes, and his argument that, you know, that it's generally known what impairment looks like for alcohol, basically, but not for marijuana. And all right. I hope I'm not misstating that.
Okay. I can say that given the difference in the way that the statutes exist with regard to impaired driving via alcohol as opposed to impaired driving via marijuana, there is a difference. Marijuana requires influence of marijuana while operating a motor vehicle does require the impairment as an element to be proven. DWI, while there is a version which requires impairment, is most commonly proven through a certain level of a substance. The difference between the two, I don't know are necessarily as profound as the appellant is suggesting. I think that officers or people who have to deal with traffic violations, whether they're alcohol or by drugs, are trained in what to look for and the observations of what impairment by alcohol or impairment by another type of substance, in this case marijuana, would look like. And some of the
but under either substance, the standard is still that the person doesn't possess the clearness of intellect and control of herself that she otherwise would have. Is that correct?
I would agree, yes. And by its very nature, I would also agree that that's a somewhat subjective standard. What would be impairment for one person wouldn't necessarily be impairment for another. And what the officer does, or what the fact finder does at trial, is look at some of the other factors surrounding that impairment to decide and reach a conclusion themselves as to whether or not that person was in fact impaired.
Can I ask you this? This is Judge Hooten. You know, as I heard the argument of the appellant, he's basically saying that while the officer did give an opinion that there was probable cause to arrest, there was no opinion given during the trial of impairment beyond a reasonable doubt. And that I think what he's saying is that you at least need some kind of evidence or opinion that there was impairment beyond a reasonable doubt. How do you respond to that
argument? Sorry.
Hello, do you hear me?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was having some trouble hearing that my computer froze on me for a few moments. I only heard the end of your question.
The question is, the argument was made by the appellant that the only thing in this record is a record, the record supporting the decision of the officer to make the arrest, which was only probable cause, whether there was probable cause for an arrest. And
yes,
that's different and insufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay.
And how do you respond to that argument?
My response to
that the officer did not give an opinion during the course of the trial that indicated that he thought there was that it was beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right. Thank you for repeating that question. I guess my response to that is that, first of all, the officer's opinion as to whether or not there was probable cause to arrest is not the only evidence in the record that supports the finding of guilt. We would point to the driving conduct, the admission of use, and those other things. With regard to the officer's or the state's failure to solicit such an opinion from the officer, my response would be that the standard of sufficiency of evidence doesn't appear to require that. I guess I would be willing to concede that if the only testimony that were offered in the record were the officer's opinion, whether it was probable cause to arrest or whether or not the defendant was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, if that were the only evidence, that would be problematic. But our position is that it's not the only evidence that's offered in support of that verdict. The evidence included the driving conduct of nearly sideswiping a bus, the odor of alcohol and the ventilating from the vehicle, odor of marijuana ventilating from the vehicle when the officers approached, the appellant's admission and her performance as observed on field sobriety testing and the ultimate test result itself.
Okay, thank you.
With regard to some of the circumstantial analysis that was raised by the panel, as well as Mr. Grigsby, the Suber case that was cited, the state would also be of the position that that particular case is distinguishable from the current case. Mr. Suber in that case did offer some affirmative alternate explanations as to why he may have performed in a certain way. The consumption evidence that was offered in that case, the consumption of marijuana was quite a bit more distant in time than it was in this case. In this particular case, there weren't any alternative explanations offered, and in fact, Ms. Easterling did, in fact, admit to consuming marijuana relatively close in proximity to the time of her driving. With all of that, Your Honors, the state would submit that the record does support a reasonable finding that the trial court was able to make, and for those reasons would ask that you affirm his decision.
All right, thank you. The appellant has 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
I'm addressing precisely the circumstantial evidence rule and how that interacts with the presumption of innocence. So for example, Clawiter has a 12-step drug recognition protocol. And that was developed specifically to detect the differences between alcohol impairment and impairment by controlled substances. So to the extent that the drug recognition protocol did not make the specific physiological findings that are often used and available to the state, in fact, the arresting officer in this case, the observing officer who testified, was a drug recognition expert, that each one of those protocols is an inference that has to be made consistent with the presumption of innocence and not with guilt. So the real question is this. There are many accidents that happen every day. The overwhelming majority of them have nothing to do with impairment by alcohol. The fact of consumption and the fact of even recent ingestion are certainly circumstances, but none of them is identical to the real critical matter here, which is causation, physiological causation proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would like to address the Suber case with respect to the presumption of innocence. I make the argument in the brief, and I just want to emphasize it here, is that the court in Suber mentions the evidence of Asperger's syndrome and sleep deprivation that the district court, which had control in the decision to decide credibility, didn't reference in the findings. And in other words, that all of the things that the court ultimately, it was essentially the appellate court, decided were insufficient to prove the matter, sleep deprivation, Asperger's, or any other of the variety of things that can cause some sort of physiological irregularity that's observed, are not things that the defendant is required to plead. These are not things the defendant is required to prove. The fact that all individuals, some have Asperger's, some have just different ordinary biological personal individuation that simply don't show up. And all of these matters in Suber are have to be presumed consistent with innocence. Otherwise, you're essentially placing a burden on the defendant to say, well, we don't believe this evidence is sufficient unless you provided very specific explanations. And that is simply not how the presumption of innocence works. In other words, the result in Suber is, even though there was affirmative evidence that was offered, is ultimately gratuitous, because all of those matters are simply the ordinary hypotheses of innocence that a defendant has absolutely no burden to produce, that the state has to disprove by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's not particularly difficult. What they have to do is to show that there are very specific, very specific physiological irregularities, and then explain how it is specifically marijuana that is the cause of them. This is a scientific matter. The whole drug recognition protocol is all about very specific physiological proof. Here in this case, you certainly have a lot of circumstances to suggest that certainly marijuana may have been a cause of what was observed, and it certainly may have. But what is lacking in this record is any real evidence to show, with the kind of scientific certainty of which it is capable, that there was a causation between the substance of marijuana and the cause of the driving conduct and the other physiological observations made by the police. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Okay, hearing no questions, then we will take the matter under advisement and we will issue an opinion within a short period of time. Thank you, Ken.